Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese. Our bi-monthly podcasts feature interviews with philosophers about their ideas as expressed in their newly published books. Today's interview is with Peter Paul Verbeek about his book Moralizing Technology, Understanding and Designing the Morality of Things, just out from the University of Chicago Press. Professor Verbeek is professor of philosophy at the University of Twente and extraordinary professor of philosophy at Delft University, both in the Netherlands. Guns don't kill people, people do. That's a common refrain from the National Rifle Association, but it expresses a certain view of our relations to the things we make that also affects our thinking about the scope of ethics. On this traditional and very intuitive view, human persons are moral agents, and artifacts, or products of technology in general, are just tools. They have no moral significance in and of themselves. Verbeek argues persuasively that this traditional view is no longer tenable, that we need to understand the moral role of technology as one of active mediation, and of ourselves as technologically mediated moral agents. Ultrasound, for example, isn't just a matter of peeking into the womb. The fetus becomes a potential patient, the womb becomes an environment for moral decisions, and the parents become responsible for making new morally relevant decisions. In general, if ought implies can, and if what we can do is expanded and conditioned by technology, then the range and nature of moral decisions and actions must also be expanded and conditioned by technology, and the designing of technology itself can be seen explicitly as having an important moral dimension. In Moralizing Technology, Verbeek spells out this new view of the moral relevance and role of artifacts and draws out some of its immediate implications. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, I'm here with Peter Paul Verbeek from the University of Twente and Delft University in the Netherlands. Peter Paul?
Hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for joining us today with New Books in Philosophy.
Thanks. It's wonderful to be here.
So we'll be talking about your new book, Moralizing Technology, Understanding and Designing the Morality of Things from University of Chicago Press. So before we begin with the book itself, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into philosophy, and in particular, the areas of philosophy that you got interested in.
Yeah, well, actually, it was quite a travel, I can say, because I think when I was at high school, it was quite hard for me to choose between, even between the humanities and the sciences. So I shifted from Latin and Greek to astronomy, to physics, to psychology, to Dutch language and literature. And it was just anything that had my interest. And then at some point, I discovered that there was this very interesting program at the University of Twente, where I still am, which was a combination of technology and philosophy. So I started doing a bachelor, something similar to that in physics. And on top of that, I did a master program in philosophy of technology. And I must say that when I was doing that, I really discovered that my heart was just a bit more with philosophy than with physics. So I decided to stick to that and to do a PhD in philosophy of technology. And I think what really fascinates me, what has always fascinated me in that, is the interesting combination of, deep intellectual engagement and also deep social engagement. So it's a lot of exciting philosophical questions that pop up as soon as you start thinking in terms of technology. It's not just applying philosophical theories to technology, but it's more trying to understand how technology challenges a lot of existing frameworks and how technology urges you to rethink how knowledge comes about if you try to understand the role of scientific instruments in knowledge production. Or, as my book is about, if you try to understand what technology does in our moral decision-making, how technology helps us to make moral decisions. So that's the part of theory. And on the other hand, you have this social engagement that thinking about technology is also thinking about a very important force in our culture. And if you succeed as a philosopher in helping engineers and policymakers to make technology better, I think you can also really contribute to a better society.
Well, that was one of the aspects of the book that I do want to get to definitely is the role of designers of technology in morality, which is not a standard sort of issue that's talked about. But I thought that was very interesting how there's a certain responsibility for the people who design and make technology that hasn't been as acknowledged as you believe it ought to be. Before we get into that, you begin the book with an anecdote a story about when you went with your wife to get an ultrasound for a child. How old is your child now?
And that child is now 9 years old, almost 10.
Oh, so okay.
So we had a lot of ultrasounds after that too.
Could you, to sort of lay the groundwork for the, deeper exploration of these issues in the book, maybe you could tell us that anecdote and all the different, morally relevant aspects of that ultrasound.
Okay. Well, the anecdote was as follows. We went to the ultrasound examination room. I think my wife was like 10 weeks expecting our child. And we were quite hesitant about having the scan done because, of course, we knew that they could also do some kind of antenatal diagnostics. And we were a bit hesitant to be put on the chair of somebody who has to make a decision about the life of your own unborn child. And not that we are very, very fundamentalist about this, not at all, but we just felt hesitant about it. And the funny thing was that the first thing we saw was a serigraph, a picture on the wall depicting an owl. It was just a coincidence, but we just got also a print of that same picture, and it was made by an artist who suffers from Down's syndrome. And that was actually quite reassuring to us because it meant at least that in that practice, ultrasound scans were not made just to make sure that your child doesn't suffer from some kind of congenital disease in order to have an abortion, but it was actually just a way of getting in touch with your unborn child without the explicit aim to make sure that nothing was wrong, so to speak. The interesting thing was that, we managed to keep the tests at bay, so we only wanted to know about the age of the fetus and not about any disease that it could have. But the funny thing was that, of course, we still kept a close eye on the looks of the person doing the scan, because even though we did not want to know anything, of course, you're still quite anxious to hear anything and to see if maybe something could be wrong. And that made us also realize that also the choice not to choose was quite an explicit choice and that we had to deal with that somehow. And then I thought, okay, actually, we stumbled upon a very interesting moral dimension of technology here. Now, even when we were not using it for the purpose that it was designed for, somehow, it still had a moral impact. It somehow changes or reorganizes your moral decisions about having an abortion or not, and about it changes the standards you can have for what is a human life or a dignified human life. And that was interesting for me, because at that very moment in the Netherlands there was a big discussion going on about the question to what extent we should maybe moralize our technologies. There was a well-known Dutch thinker, Hans Achterhuis, who just wrote an article about the question if we should maybe stop moralizing each other and start moralizing all the things that we use. And he said, we can try to moralize each other not to shower too long or to turn off the lights in your hallway when you go upstairs. But you could also delegate those tasks to technologies and make sure that they do it for you. Of course, many people were quite hesitant about that, and they felt that actually the morality was with the humans and not with the things. But then I thought, actually, this issue is much more subtle. It's not only about can you delegate a task to a technology that they do the moral work for you. It's much more subtle in the sense that technologies are also involved in how we do ethics, and not only by steering our behavior in a direct way, like having a speed bump that makes sure that you don't drive too fast near a school, but having technology that also, have an impact on how you think and what kind of moral choices you make. So that was actually, for me, the start of this whole research and this whole book about how technologies are not just doing ethics, but how they help us to do ethics and how to conceptualize it, how to conceptualize this moral significance of technologies, and how to conceptualize the impact this has for moral agency of human beings.
So you describe your experience with the ultrasound as it play an actively mediating role in not just ultrasound, but of course technology in general, actively mediating in our moral interpretations and moral decisions and moral practices. And you to sort of lay the sort of background philosophical groundwork for that in chapter two, you describe this approach to technology and morality in terms of mediation as a post-humanist or non-humanist ethical approach in which morality isn't just a human affair, but it's a matter of human technology interaction or a human technology association. So if you could just maybe just explain a little bit that sort of, backgrounding to your view.
Maybe non-humanist is a better term than post-humanist. Okay. What I tried to explain there is that I think that a lot of ethical theory at this time is focusing on humanism in the sense that it's only human beings who can do ethics. It's only human beings who are to praise or to blame for moral actions. It's only human beings who can have moral intentions, who can be morally responsible, etc. Of course, it's quite obvious, and I am also fully aware that you make quite a lot of mess in ethical theory if you start expanding that view. Still, I think we have to do that, because if you ignore the moral role of objects, then you throw out the child with the bathwater. So what I try to do in chapter two is, actually a bit metaphysical, but I try to work towards an alternative view of the relations between subject and objects in ethics, where I try to end up at a view in which it's not just humans who are doing ethics, neither just things. I don't think things are moral agents in themselves, but I try to explain how humans and things together do ethics, how things fundamentally help to shape human experience of the world, human actions, how things are, very often mediating how human beings have a relation to their environment. And one important dimension of this mediation is a moral dimension. As soon as things have an impact on how you interpret the world or how you are inclined to act, then, in some way, they help to answer the question of how to act or how to live. And that makes them morally, it doesn't make them moral agents, but it gives them a form of moral relevance.
Okay, so one of the things that I was thinking as I read the chapter three, I suppose, in which you're contrasting your view with standard accounts of the moral status of objects. One thing that occurred to me was the phrase, guns don't kill people, people do, which, you know, people here will, in the United States, will say in terms of defending, you know, gun rights and so forth. And, and that struck me as a very clear way of expressing the presupposition about the role of objects that that you are arguing against. And so maybe by using that example, you might flesh out a bit this idea that the nature of moral agency is different when you're when you're including technology in the mix.
Yeah, it's nice that you bring this in. Actually, it's an example of Latour, Bruno Latour, who wrote a rather funny article about the moral agency of things, where he uses the beautiful English word of the gunman to explain how things can have, well, a very deep role in moral agency and how morality actually is a hybrid affair. And so he plays a bit with this discussion between the NRA and the anti-gun movement, where, of course, the anti-gun movement people say, okay, guns kill people, so we shouldn't have guns. And the NRA says, no, it's people who kill people. You cannot blame the guns. And actually, that latter view is much in line, I think, with a lot of views in ethical theory who would say that you could never blame a thing for an action, right? It's only the human being using the thing. But I think Latour quite convincingly shows that, well, a human being with a gun is an entirely different agent than a human being without a gun. That actually the agent who is somehow responsible for the shooting is an assembly of a human and a non-human element. Introducing a gun in a situation changes a lot, changes the intentions that human beings can have from just expressing their anger to killing somebody. That also changes the properties, you could say, of a gun from something like projecting a missile into killing somebody, you know, when it gets somehow connected to the intentions of a human being. So the entities that enter into the various assemblies, well, help to shape each other and also help to shape the actions that come about. And the beautiful thing of the English language is that you then have the word gunman, which has this beautiful hybrid of gun and man in it. And I think that's quite a good expression of what I aim to arrive at in my book. So I don't aim to claim that things are moral agents in themselves. I mean, I'm not an animist who thinks that things have their own intentions or their own secret lives or something. I do believe in human agency, of course, but I do not believe in autonomous human agency. I think that in many cases, in most cases where human beings act, their actions are mediated by things, by devices, and most often by technological devices that were designed and made by human beings. And that, well, the resulting ethical dimension of these actions are actually not only human, but are somehow distributed over human and non-human elements, as is the case when there is a shooting.
So the responsibility is the man and the gun.
Yeah, and that's
not just the man.
No, but of course there is a special responsibility for the human being, because human beings can, of course, also be aware of the mediating effects that things can have on them. But the other interesting thing is that as soon as you include things in moral responsibility, you can also introduce a notion of the moral responsibility of designers. Because those things are not just there, but they were designed and made and organized by human beings. So rather than, you could say, taking away from the concept of moral responsibility by claiming that, well, things have a role too in it, I think you actually add to it, because you now also create space for the responsibility of designers in the actions that human beings perform with the help of objects.
So a safety on the trigger is a morally relevant design feature, right?
Definitely. Yeah.
Well, how about designing a weapon in general? I mean, okay, it's one thing to say that we've got, artifacts that we need to build certain safety features into, like with the gun or toys, right, that have safety features built into them. That's one way, I guess, suppose, in which designers are, morally in positions of moral responsibility, actually. But there's also the further issue of the moral responsibility of simply building, designing and building any of these things just from the get-go, right? Is it important to distinguish between those two types of moral responsibility?
Well, I think one of the lines in the book is that you always have two dimensions of technical artifacts. One is the dimension of its functionality, when the thing just does what it was designed for. And I think that's the level at which you are speaking if you say, well, is it good at all to design a weapon? You can have a lot of ideas about that. I think not too many people would be too enthusiastic about that, even though there are also theories about the just war, and et cetera. But of course, that's one dimension. Can a weapon in itself be good at all? But the second dimension of things is that as soon as they function, they also reorganize the world in a specific way. On top of their functioning, they shape all kinds of relations between human beings and their world. And that's also where you can see a moral significance. So if ultrasound was designed to, it was not designed for medical purposes at all. It was designed to detect sea mines in boats. But as soon as you introduce it in a medical context and you say that it's now introduced to detect, an indication of Down syndrome, then you can also say that, on top of that, it starts to mediate. It starts to make parents responsible. It starts to change a lot of things. Suddenly the unborn child is translated into a possible patient. And a congenital disease is somehow translated into a disease that can be prevented by having an abortion. And expecting a child is somehow translated into choosing for that child, not only before the conception, which we can do now quite easily, of course, but also after the conception. Will we carry on with this pregnancy? So it's two dimensions that you can address for technology, how it functions and how it mediates. And what you say about weapons is, is it good to design an object with a function to kill at all? Mm-hmm. Well, that's, of course, a very interesting and a very important question to ask. But I think the main line that I tried to develop in this book is that extra line, the mediation line. So as soon as an object does what it does, it starts to do more. And how could we analyze and understand that?
Okay. And how about enhancement as opposed to artifacts? In other words, technology that's intended to improve us, the agents themselves. I mean, does that have the same kind of treatment for you as something that can be put away someplace else?
Yeah, well, I think there you enter into a completely different configuration of humans and technology.
Uh-huh.
I think if you speak about the morally significant technologies that I address in my book, it's most often technologies that are in a configuration of use, as you could call it. You can use them and you can put them away and you can decide to use them or not. But a lot of the human enhancement technologies really embody some kind of a physical boundary blurring between the humans and the technologies. It's about brain implants, about drugs, about engineering of your genome.
Right.
So that's it's a different configuration. It's a hybrid as well, but not a hybrid in terms of how you think and how you have moral arguments, but really a hybrid in physical terms. But in a sense, I think there are similarities because, the issue of human enhancement also shows that, there is this deep intertwinement between humans and technologies and that it might not be very helpful to choose an ethical approach in which you feel that the main question to answer in ethics is if we should say yes or no to a technology, if it's allowed to use it or if it's not allowed to use it. Yeah. Because most of the time, the technologies are already there and are already doing their mediating work. They have already made us somehow responsible in new ways. And then the question is more of how to accompany the introduction of these technologies in such a way that their mediating role takes on a good shape. So in the book, in the final chapter, chapter 8 of the book, I try to call that an ethics of technology accompaniment rather than technology, now you could say assessment, and not standing outside of the technologies and try to give an assessment about the question if it's good or bad, but try to, well, to move along with it and try to understand what's at stake, how it changes things, how it mediates things, in order to be able to feed that back into the design, maybe to change the technologies or to change the social and the ways in which it's introduced in society, or to equip users with the means to understand what's at stake when they use these technologies in order to help them to shape their lives in a productive and in a good way in interaction with these mediations. So it's a different model of doing ethics.
Right, right. So the mediating role or the mediated subject, as you also call us now, maybe you could just be a little bit more specific about exactly this, you know, good examples of the kinds of mediation that you mean.
Yeah, well, if you put it in broad lines, in the book I try to distinguish between two spheres of mediation, which are both actually emphasizing one dimension of this human-world relation where technologies play a role. So it's the sphere of action and of the way in which we live our lives on the one hand. On the other hand, it's the sphere of human experience, human perception, interpretations of the world. So I think the ultrasound example is mostly on the line of experience and interpretation. Ultrasound helps the fetus to be there in a new way. It constitutes for us in a new way what a fetus is, and it actually also reconstitutes us as people who are expecting a child. On the other hand, you have technology that have maybe a bit more direct impact on how we behave. Ranging from the obvious examples of speed bumps to also a bit less, you could say direct technologies, like technologies that can somehow persuade us to behave in specific ways or, give us feedback on our behavior. And that also works through our perception and our interpretation, so to speak, but not in this direct way as ultrasound works, and that you really get a different kind of representation of what your fetus is, but more by giving feedback to you on how you act.
You mean like a seatbelt, buzzer or something, that kind of a thing?
That's all the very mundane examples that Latour gives. So indeed, there is the safety belt warning that you can get in your car that gives a beep or that even somehow refuses to start the engine if you don't wear your safety belt. There's also this a very well-known example of Langdon Winner of the low-hanging overpasses over the parkways on Long Island to the beach that were built so low that only cars can pass there and no buses, which in the times that they were built made sure that only people who could afford a car could go to the beach, which in those days were white people and not the African-American people. So there's a lot of interesting examples of how technological devices can actually, embody some form of morality. At the same time, these examples also show that there are very different ways in which technologies can have this moral significance, so to speak. Because if you think about the low-hanging overpasses, you could say, in a sense, the central aspect of its moral significance is not in the things themselves there, but it's in the ideas of their architect. It's Moses, the man who designed the overpasses, who was well known for his racist ideas and who tried to install his racist ideology in those overpasses. On the other hand, you have people who do not put all the morality in the humans, but who put all the morality in the things. And people who claim that actually a computer can be a moral agent, that a computer can be capable of making a good moral decision. Then it's not in the humans, but it's in the technologies that all the ethics is to be found.
I thought you ruled that out.
Yeah.
I thought that wasn't you.
No. Okay. No. Well, I mean, what I try to claim in my book is that, well, it's somewhere between, well, or somewhere beyond this opposition, so to speak. That, right. So it's always in this mix of humans and non-humans, of humans and technology, that ethics comes about.
So are engineers somehow more morally responsible than the rest of us, because since they are the ones who are creating and designing these things?
I wouldn't call it more, but differently. I think there are many points of application for ethical reflection if you look at technologies. So there is a specific responsibility for engineers and designers, just like there is a specific responsibility for policymakers and a specific responsibility for users. I think many groups in society help to shape the impacts of technologies on our daily lives. And designers, of course, have a very special role there, because they are the ones who, well, help to shape the physical properties of those technologies. It doesn't mean, though, that they have the final say. I mean, there are many examples of technologies who were designed for entirely different purposes than what they ended up to be used for. And one of the most well-known examples maybe here is the energy-saving light bulbs, which, especially in a European context that I know, have often been shown to make people use more energy rather than less, because people feel that it's so cheap to, well, to lighten their garden or the facade of their houses or whatever, that they decide to leave the lights on all day. And, well, they end up using more energy because they think that it's so cheap. So that's just, well, to make sure that the engineers are not completely in charge. But still, they help to shape what technologies do. And part of what I try to accomplish with this book is to equip designers with a vocabulary to anticipate those mediating effects of technologies, so that they don't just feel that they are designing a functional thing, which is supposed to fulfill a specific function in society, but that they understand that as soon as it starts to have that function, it will also reorganize people's lives. It will shape new relations between users and their environment, and it will also then change people's interpretation of the world, people's patterns of action, and therefore it will also have some kind of moral load, moral charge, so to speak.
So you call their role at this point as involving a kind of implicit moral decision-making, and advocate making this this implicit decision-making more explicit.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if you could say a word about, you know, what you have in mind.
By making it explicit. Well, you can do that in various ways. Well, maybe a very good example of what I'm working on at this moment is that with a PhD student, we are involved in a project which is also sponsored by big companies like Philips, which is about usability. And that's a buzzword in the design circles. It's about making products better usable, not only functional, but also understandable for human beings. And what we try to claim there is that actually usability involves, paying attention to the ways in which all those technologies have an impact on our behavior, how they help to shape how we act, and also how they shape the practices in which they have a role. And then we try to give them some kind of tool. Actually, the tool was designed by this PhD student, Steven Dorrestein, who does very interesting work. And this tool helps designers to anticipate how technologies shape perceptions or actions, or how they shape the ideas that people can have about the world that they live in. And that can help. That can be just a plug-in, so to speak, in the design methods that designers use.
What sort of tool is this?
Well, it's we call it it's a workshop that we can give. It can take an afternoon or a whole day, and it can be part of designing a product, but then in such a way that the designers are invited to anticipate how the product they are designing will have an impact on the experiences, the interpretations, the behavior of the users that will eventually use a product. So that can help them to anticipate what the thing they are making can do more than they would just think if they would only look at the functionality of the product. And that as soon as you design, to go back to the ultrasound example, if you design that you are always designing more than a functional thing to look into the womb, that will also reorganize moral responsibilities, moral perceptions, moral decisions. And as soon as you do that, you can really help designers to, give more shape to their moral responsibility than they could without this. And then they could just ask themselves, well, is it good to design this thing or not? Is it good to design a weapon or not? But they cannot ask themselves, how should I design it? How could I make sure that this technology plays some kind of desirable mediating roles?
Could you give an example of some technology in development or in which this sort of widening of the horizon of the designers, right? Because that's what it sounds like to me, that in through this workshop, they're encouraged to think about what they're designing in terms of how, you know, ordinary human beings might actually start using it and then anticipate those sorts of other uses, sort of like off-label drugs, you know, off-label, you know, prescriptions of drugs. You know, I mean, people, pharmaceutical companies or the, you know, drug, you know, FDA will approve a drug for a particular use, but of course doctors are, they can write prescriptions how they wish, right? And in a sense, people are kind of like doctors in that sense, in that once you get a technology, they're going to use it for whatever they want to. And the ultrasound example is actually very interesting. It was for, you know, finding minds, and here we are looking at fetuses.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, maybe the best example to give also comes from the book, and also to give a bit an idea of what's in the book. And there's a chapter in which I try to give the example of the field of what they call something like persuasive technologies that try to persuade people to behave in specific ways. That's actually an interesting case to think about in terms of mediation, because of course persuasive technologies were already designed to mediate and they were designed to have an impact on people's behavior. But the interesting thing is that as soon as you try to think about this functionality also as mediations, you can actually see much more. Let me just give one example. There's an interesting design in that field, which is called the food phone, which is a phone that was designed to help people with overweight to lose weight. Actually, there are new versions of it now, but the one that I discussed was the one that uses the camera in your phone. So you're supposed to make pictures of everything you eat. You MMS that to some kind of central agency. They make a calculation of the calories in it. At the same time, it has a step counter, so it tries to make a calculation of how much you burned, and at the end of the day you get a report. Of course that's a very interesting technology, it could have the function that it was somehow designed for, but at the same time you can say, okay, what does this technology actually do in the relation between people and their food, and what does it do between people and a social environment? It might also make it very stressful to eat anything, or it puts so much pressure and weight on how people experience their food that might also have an adversary effect. So it's interesting if you have this framework that I tried to sketch out in the book of how to analyze the mediating role of technologies, that you can maybe also somehow predict mechanisms that could actually undo the intended effects of technology, so that could come on top of it, and that would have different impacts, and that could help. So then you could also take responsibility as a designer in a more broad way, and also taking care of the quality of the lives of people using the technologies, and not only asking yourself if it's good or not, or if it's safe or not.
Okay. And as far as the users of technology, okay, now focusing more on the human beings, right, the central agents. One of the things that struck me as I was reading the book is there's that old phrase everybody learns when you're taking a course in ethics or moral psychology or something, that ought implies can, right? That if you are morally obliged to do something, it implies that you can do it. You can't be obliged to do something that you cannot do. And what technology does, it expands what you can do, right? And so, therefore, it seems inevitably to expand what we ought to do. And I guess I was thinking, you know, is this cycle virtuous or vicious? Right? I mean, does technology, sort of morally enslave us in this way by ever expanding what we can do?
Yeah, well, I think the very question that you ask might be an expression of the humanism that I tried to overcome in the book.
Okay.
Because it seems to start from a radical separation between a sphere of humans and a sphere of technologies.
Okay.
And the question is if technologies can enslave humans, as if they are some kind of an alien force invading in the human sphere, and we should somehow set limits to that.
Right.
And of course, it's important that we do not become the slaves of technology. So that's actually, of course, not what I try to propagate in my book. But I try to blur the boundaries between humans and technologies just a bit more. Because I think if you try to understand what a human being is, it's hard to avoid including technology in that. We've always been the beings that we are. Because of the technologies that we have used. I mean, also writing or making clothes or weapons or tools. I mean, that's all that that made us human. And in that sense, I think the main task of ethics should not be to ask itself how we can keep the human being pure from technology. But the main task should be, how to give a good shape to this human technology assembly that we've always been. And for me, it has been very helpful to read how Foucault actually reread ancient ethics, Greek ethics, actually. In the last two volumes of Foucault's Ethics of Sexuality, he has a very interesting analysis of how this very old ethical framework worked. And that can also be very helpful to understand the ethics of technology. And what he does there is actually, he tries to understand the role of power in human life, not as something alien, and that's actually how Foucault is often read, and that powers are somehow, you could say, oppressing people, and we need to find ways to get around that, to do subversive actions, etc. Many people read Foucault's work on power like that. But what he does in the last two books on sexuality is actually he says that, no, we need to include power in our understanding of the human being. We are all, we've always been the product of power relations, and what we should not do is to find ways to get around power, but we should find good ways of shaping ourselves in interaction with power. And he analyzes that, or he discusses that in terms of how the ancient Greek dealt with sexuality. And just by discussing the question, how did ethics actually become a matter of, how did sex become a matter of ethics in the first place? Why do moral about sex? Mm-hmm. And very interestingly, he describes the passions in that book as some kind of power that's being exerted upon you, and that you did not choose for, but that comes over you, as it were. And that, the core of the ancient Greek ethical approaches to sexuality was not to find rules about what was somehow allowed and what was not allowed, but it was how to shape yourself as a sexual subject, so how to integrate the passions in your lives. And that meant somehow avoiding the two extremes, as it often works in these old ethical frameworks. So it's not denying the passions, because it would be denying a part of yourself, which could never be a good way of living your life. But it would also imply not becoming their slaves, not to let the passions take over. So what it was about is how to find a way to govern those passions, to incorporate them in your daily lives. And then, that's a very interesting way to look at technology as well. The mediating powers of technologies are always there, have always been there. It would be foolish, I think, to deny that. It would be equally foolish to say that we should get away with something like gravity or language or something. Those are things that, well, are part of the human life, of the human condition even maybe. So what we should do is try to understand how these mediations work and try to find ways to shape ourselves in interaction with those mediations. Because recognizing that they are there doesn't mean that we have to blindly follow what they imply. We can shape ourselves, give shape to our mediated selves in a productive way by understanding how these mediating technologies reorganize our lives and by getting involved in that, by incorporating them in specific ways into our daily lives, or by getting involved in how they were designed so that they would also have different mediating effects in a physical sense.
I think what I intended was actually to push the idea or press more on the idea of how we go about doing that. And let me try to be a little bit more specific. The more that we have we're involved with our technologies, in the way that you advocate, clearly when we have things that are available, and we become aware of the different ways that our decision making and our the scope of our action has changed. In what way can we be, I suppose, more explicitly involved with or in control of or in some sense, in control of how those changing spheres of action and decision making actually occur?
Yeah, okay. Well, I think that's a very important issue that you raise. I think in a sense it has become part of, well, being a citizen in a technological culture that we become somehow literate in technology as well, which doesn't mean that we understand all physical aspects of technology, but that we also, well, equip people in our world with the ability to understand how these technologies play a role in their daily lives. So I think it's a matter of education, in a sense. And you could already start with that at primary school and at high school, learning kids nowadays how social media helped to change their notions of friendship and intimacy, etc. And I mean, there are so many examples in your daily lives of technologies that you can always use them in education. And I think that's very important because, well, the main pitfall in our thinking of technology is the concept of function. And people always think that technologies are just functional. They're instruments. They do what they were designed for. And the most interesting aspect of the philosophy of technology is that you can always show that that's way too shallow to understand a technology. As soon as it starts to function, then it only starts. Then all the mediations start to be there. Then technologies start to reorganize how we think, how we act. And that's what we need to learn, people in this world, that technologies are just a very fundamental force in their lives. Now, we do that for the ideas, and we educate people in the main ideas that have popped up over the past centuries or millennia, and they learn about socialism, they learn about world religions, etc. Why not teach them also about technology and how technology has an impact on how they think and how they act?
So is there any way to go about that sort of education, or is this, you mentioned social media, and so the latest is the latest iPhone version. Apparently, you can talk into it and dictate your texts, and this is a wonderful thing because now you don't have to type onto the tiny little keyboard. You can just dictate right into the phone, and it will send the text message. Which is a terrific thing, except now people are starting to complain that how annoying it is to hear everybody around them loudly dictating into their iPhones. And so what's happening is decisions are being made. Oh, I'm going to use, I have this new technology. I'm going to now use this to dictate where once upon a time I had to type. And now it's having all these other effects on other people. Nowadays, people are complaining about it. The cycle goes, we get used to it. There's a New Yorker cartoon, and then somehow it gets incorporated into our decision making about when I'm going to text now, as opposed to when I, you know, did before, and other actions, right? So our actions and decisions get shaped by the technology, but we're not it's sort of like willy-nilly. It just kind of happens. And I'm just wondering if there's any sort of, education or explicit direction that can happen with this, or is it always going to be, you know, whatever happens, what happens?
Yeah, well, I think, again, the way you perceive this depends on the basic ideas you have about the human-technology relations that could be there. Okay. Because I think we are not as powerless as you might think from the account that you just gave.
Okay.
Of course, it just happens in a sense. New technologies come and go also. And there's not much we can do to stop that. Right, but it doesn't imply that we just have to accept them as they are, because very often, we incorporate them in very specific ways in our daily lives. I mean, if you take the very example of cell phones, I still recall the first years when we had cell phones. People really had to learn how to integrate them in social life. I mean, in the beginning, people would just answer their phone all the time. So you were just having a conversation with somebody and he would pick up the phone because it was ringing, right? Well, that's not what people do now. People use their voicemail and they call back. In the train we have here in Holland, people use a train a lot. And you used to have the non-smoking places, but now you are not allowed to smoke anywhere in the train. And now you have the non-phone call places in the train where you're just where you know if you sit there, you can sit there quietly and nobody will be making a phone call. You can just do some work. So somehow we also learned to live with the specific ways in which cell phones organize social life by adapting ourselves and also by reorganizing our social world. Of course, a cell phone is quite an innocent example, but I think it nicely shows that it's not just one-way traffic. It's not just technology is dictating us. We also learn how to integrate them in our into our lives. And we had to do that very often. I mean, in the book, I also discuss Plato, who was very much against writing, and because who can know who will run away with your ideas, right? Or we would never be able to remember anything if we can write everything on paper. It would be end of culture. Of course, for us now, it's something like the beginning of culture. Everything before writing was prehistory now. And so we found a way to incorporate writing into our existence, and it really belongs to the human being now, I think, that we can read and write. And we don't experience this as something alien anymore, but it's something that constitutes our being human. So we're not powerless. Indeed, in a sense, technology is autonomous. Of course, it's a human activity, and its direction can always be changed a bit, but it goes on. But the fact that it goes on doesn't mean that we just have to sit and wait and see what happens, because we can really get involved in how it will affect us.
Well, there the sort of global dimension to this is not just with cell phones, for example, but, you know, Skype and, you know, various internet technologies that effectively make, you know, talking or communicating with anybody anywhere, or practically anywhere, as easy as, you know, somebody in the next room. And those sorts of relationships, you know, cross borders and nationalities and everything else. And those seem to be the sorts of relationships that will be kind of on deck in terms of trying to figure out how we're going to manage those things. And the moral dimension there is, you know, sort of the more you know about what's going on in places that are far from you, that you never see, but now you hear about them. You know, to what extent does this expand our moral responsibilities now that we, you know, not only hear about things, but we're actually in fairly intimate, you know, relatively speaking, intimate contact with them?
Yeah, I think it has a tremendous impact on that because, well, the sphere of your moral engagement really expands because of technologies. And, of course, it did already with the advent of radio and TV. And, of course, the internet adds a completely new dimension to that. It could even become so big that it's hard to take responsibility at all because you wouldn't know where to start, as it were. But it will also mean, I think, that, a lot of social dimensions of our lives get organized in a different way. Politics gets organized in a different way as soon as we can really feel engaged with what's happening in Afghanistan or in Iraq or whatever. And so I think all those new dimensions in politics also have a lot of relations with all the new media that we have. At the same time, I think the example also beautifully shows that a lot of the fears about new media and about technology in general, and that it would alienate people from each other, that they might be just a bit too big. Of course, there is always the risk of alienation because, well, you get new types of relations with new you could say characteristics. But at the same time, I think what Skype does or what Facebook can do is really, well, expanding your social sphere. And at least it enables me to stay in touch with friends, but also with other scientists and philosophers to exchange ideas. It really expands the world in which you live. And in that sense, it also really makes my whole engagement with the world much bigger and not smaller. So the nature of the contact is different, and you lack aspects that you would have in real life. But I'm glad in some cases that I don't have to wait until I can see somebody in real life in order to have a good philosophical talk with somebody.
So let me you raise a question, an issue in actually towards the beginning of the book. When you're talking about speed bumps and using technology, sort of to do what things that we ought to do. And that sort of made me think, well, if we can get things to do what we ought to do, does that somehow change the nature of morality? I mean, for example, you're supposed to give to charity, and sometimes it's said, you know, you should give until it hurts or something like that. And this whole idea of pain and morality being difficult and hard and somehow, you know, involving suffering for some greater good, right? I mean, the idea of morality itself is always attached in some sense to this idea of you know,
sacrifice,
exactly. And if technology comes along and allows us to, you know, sort of do the actions without much pain or with no pain, would we be worse off, morally speaking, if you know, acting morally were pain-free?
Yeah, I think so. So that's definitely not the point that I try to make in the book.
No, I know, but
yeah, no, but it's very interesting that you bring it up. I mean, that would be something like making ethics into some kind of commodity, and that you can delegate to a machine, and then we have it all solved, right? So that's definitely not what I want. I discuss it in the beginning of the book because it's part of the discussion that we had here in the Netherlands about the moralization of devices, and should we also delegate some aspects of our morality to technologies because we ourselves are sometimes too weak to do it, and maybe the technology should help us. So, I mean, it's an interesting idea that technologies could support us maybe in being moral. But, I think the whole project of the book is to move beyond this and to see this as a first stepping stone, maybe some kind of provocation, and to try to understand how actually technologies do much more. not only that, and that it, in a sense it also can be quite painful to take responsibility for your existence in relation to those technologies. I mean, the experience that I described with the ultrasound example was not pain-free. So it was acknowledging a moral significance of a technology, but the decision not to have any information about the medical condition of the child was actually quite hard for us. It appeared to charge us with a different kind of responsibility too. So it doesn't make being moral pain-free, not at all. Actually, I think it adds to being moral, because it makes you somehow morally responsible for many more things that you can be when you do not see the moral significance of things. As soon as you see it, you become responsible for how you organize your life in interaction with the technologies. You become responsible for the design of the technologies. You can also become responsible for the ways in which they are socially embedded and organized. So the pain only gets bigger, I'm afraid.
Well, that was what I was kind of getting at before when I asked about technology expanding what we can do. And by doing that, expanding what we ought to do. And when I asked you whether this cycle is, vicious or virtuous, I mean, with the ever expanding what we can, there has to be, seems to be, this ever expanding what we ought.
But then I think at the same time, we only discuss in ethical terms what's somehow problematic. I mean, there's a lot of morality that's just running as daily practice because we all agree on how it should go.
Yeah.
So, I think part of what the book shows is that this whole agreement can also be in things. So that could indeed be the cases where technologies take over or where technologies organize or socialize in such a way that we can actually all agree on it. And it only becomes a matter of ethics if we feel that something might be wrong there. So in a sense, if it's a vicious cycle, then maybe technologies can also help us to make it a virtuous cycle in a sense.
Okay. We're just about out of time. So let me just ask you, where do you go from here with this project or what you have planned for your next project?
Well, actually, I was very happy with you bringing up the issue of human enhancement, because that's what I'm working on now.
Okay.
So. Oh, I mean, what I did for ethics in this book, and how technology challenge the main concept was with which we do ethics. I try to do that now for philosophical anthropology. So, how do technologies challenge the ways in which we understand the human being? And if we then need to reconceptualize the human being in such a way that it includes technology, how could that then have an impact on the ethical discussions about human enhancement? So that's what I'm working on now. Actually, I just had a little Dutch book out this year about this issue, and that will now grow into a big English academic book, which I hope to be finished in 2 years or something.
Excellent. I'm tempted to keep asking questions, but I think we should probably start, because it's been about an hour now. So I just wanted to thank you for giving me your time and discussing your book, Moralizing Technology, Understanding and Designing the Morality of Things. Thank
You're
you very wonderful. Much.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We've been listening to an interview with Peter Paul Verbeek about his new book, Moralizing Technology, Understanding and Designing the Morality of Things, from the University of Chicago Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed our podcast, and thank you for listening.